Hello, and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Hannah White. Nobody predicted that this week would be dominated by Number 10 having a massive diplomatic row with another European country. So is Rishi Sunak losing his marbles? We're going to catch up on this week's extraordinary bust-up with Greece and ask, what on earth is going on? Look beyond the Elgin Marbles headlines and you'll find a couple of stories swirling around Westminster that might seem a little niche, a bit technical, and kind of deep into Institute for Government territory. But these are stories that are beginning to bubble to the surface. The first is around access talks, the moment that opposition parties begin meeting the civil service ahead of a general election. They haven't started yet, but should they? And the second is the role of the Cabinet Secretary. With Simon Case still on medical leave, and now we understand unable to give evidence in person to the COVID inquiry this year, what does his absence mean for how government runs? And what should happen next? We'll take a look. It's also been a week since Rishi Sunak promised that he would set out how he would get his Rwanda asylum flights off the ground, despite the Supreme Court's verdict. Well, we're still waiting, as are an increasingly restless gaggle of Conservative backbenchers, and even some frontbenchers. So what could Sunak's scheme look like, and will it work? Joining me in the studio are a duo of colleagues who are very much at home in the most niche and specialist parts of IFG territory, and that's Alex Thomas and Alice Lilly. Hi, both.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Hannah.
And I'm delighted that we're joined today by Laura Silver, the editor of Politics Home. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Well, let's begin with a look at the surprise story of the week, the future of the Elgin Marbles. In an interview with Laura Koonsberg, the Greek Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, reiterated his country's request for the marbles, which are currently housed at the British Museum, to be returned to Greece. And that seemed to annoy Rishi Sunak so much that the PM cancelled planned talks with his Greek counterpart. Laura, is that what's going on?
I think it is. I mean, I think there's been a lot of chat all week about whether it's a dead cat, whether they're trying to distract from the Rwanda stuff, for example. But I think Rishi Sunak probably does actually care about it. But that's what is so baffling. Why pick this fight? Why not meet the Greek Prime Minister? It's not like this is a new position from Greece. And I think it was particularly telling that Keir Starmer was able to meet with the Greek Prime Minister and then, you know, makes him look like he's working on something that perhaps Rishi Sunak should be. But no, I think it's a good demonstration of, I think, what's come up in a few themes this week, actually, about the sort of political naivety of Rishi Sunak. And perhaps he thinks he's sticking by his convictions, but actually it ends up resulting in a strange row that the public don't care about. There's a lot of talk as well about, is he trying to spark a culture war and win over the right of the party and right-wing voters, but voters don't care.
And you might have thought that actually the talks he could have had with the Greek Prime Minister on the subject of immigration, given, you know, that Greece is a key partner for the UK on that sort of issue, would have been more important than a culture war type story.
Well, quite. And, you know, Greece has got a similar crisis. I think politically they're similar. You know, they could have had this united front about why Greece and the UK were going to tackle this together. And Rishi Sunak could have looked strong and like he was doing something on small boats, even where all the Rwanda stuff is delayed. So, yeah, it's an odd choice.
Alex, does this say more about the Number 10 operation or Sunak's temper?
A bit of both, probably, like so often. I mean, I agree exactly with what Laura was saying. It's pretty weird, very strange situation that you should make a big row about this that most people don't, you know, really care about. It's a kind of talking point rather than anything else. I sort of hope he's learned a bit of a lesson on the narrow politics as well as the big stuff. He had a mauling, really, from Keir Starmer, gave him an open goal at Prime Minister's question time. And it does suggest there that, you know, they haven't really thought some of these things through. He seemed to be, I mean, to Laura's point, he did seem to be genuinely affronted, tried to make an issue that supposedly the Greek Prime Minister had given a commitment that he wouldn't raise the Parthenon sculptures, Elgin Marbles question on this visit. And then he did. But then he was asked the question by Laura Koonsberg on the Sunday morning political programme. So if the Greek Prime Minister, you're not going to say, oh, I'll just sidestep that. I haven't, you know, I'm not going to talk about that on this visit. You're going to give the lines that any Greek Prime Minister would. So it seems very strange, a bit kind of, you know, not enormously grown up. But the serious point, I mean, this is not an enormously serious story, clearly, but the serious point is exactly what Laura said, which is that Greece is a close ally. The immigration questions that you raised, the security in the Eastern Mediterranean, you know, there are a whole host of things that could kick off over there in an already unstable world. They should be ideological bedfellows, both coming from, you know, conservative parties. It was pretty strange, and I think must have reflected both personal irritation and just a bit of kind of geopolitical naivety.
And Alice, you, like I, are one of our chief parliamentary watchers. Alex mentioned there that Keir Starmer really managed to sort of land some punches with Sunak. He had this line about Sunak having the reverse Midas touch, which seemed to get a lot of traction with the media. But do you think that voters really care about who wins PMQs? It often seems to me it's more about managing your own backbenchers than it really is about fighting the opposition.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it's very easy for all of us sort of around Westminster and Whitehall who probably do watch PMQs to kind of think about, oh, who's won this week's round? When actually the reality is for most people, you might see one or two clips, perhaps a couple of good lines on the news once a week, and that's probably really the end of the matter. I think the other thing is, if you have a situation like we've had this week, where actually people are saying, wow, you know, the leader of the opposition really seems to have kind of trounced the Prime Minister in PMQs this week, that's not something that's really coming from nowhere. I think if people are noticing that, they're probably noticing that because it fits in with a kind of broader narrative about perhaps the Prime Minister being in trouble or about polling for Labour being very good. So PMQs on its own probably doesn't really matter to the average person in the street, perhaps as much as we might like to think it does.
Exactly to that point, the thing that matters is with your colleagues and jeering up people in Parliament. Watching it last night, you know, while I was cooking dinner, I was struck. I was actually watching Jeremy Hunt's face more than I was Rishi Sunak's, and he was sitting there, sort of, looking very kind of passive. And I used to work for Jeremy Hunt, and so a bit of me was wondering what's going through Jeremy Hunt's mind as he's, you know, watching this, you know, this kind of back and forth across the dispatch box.
Laura, Sunak's sort of counter to try to sort of counterattack Keir Starmer was to accuse him of supporting the EU rather than his own country. Do you think that's a clue that Sunak's considering trying to make Brexit an election issue?
I think so, because it's been a successful election issue for the Conservatives for, you know, the past few years, hasn't it? But I think they'll have difficulty with that because, you know, a lot of the public are starting to see issues with Brexit, or the things that people voted for, they're not necessarily seeing dividends on, for example, immigration. And I think it's a very fine line for Labour to tread. But I think I can imagine those sort of incremental, not quite rejoinings, but incremental realignments, which I think Labour has hinted at, and also the Tories have done with things like Horizon. And, you know, I think if Keir Starmer can have a careful line on that, then the public probably won't be too upset about it.
Do you agree, Alex?
Yeah, there's a sort of, I mean, it's a sort of operation of gravity type thing. I think I don't for a second think that the Labour Party will want to make a huge deal of it. But as others, you know, on this podcast and elsewhere, much better qualified than I've said, if you're the Labour Party and you want to take decisions that aren't going to cost enormous amounts of money to try and encourage growth, then, you know, removing barriers to trade is one of those things that you can do. So there is a, you know, there is a sort of centre of gravity thing. I don't, you know, as we say, I don't for a moment think that we're, anyway close to making a big political move to get closer to the European Union, but a series of incremental decisions, as we've actually seen already under this government, parts of the, you know, Windsor Agreement, some of the sort of micro level things that have happened. If the Northern Ireland Assembly gets up and running again, that might have consequences for how the dynamic plays out in terms of alignment with the EU on that side of stuff. So it does feel like there's at least potentially an operation of gravity thing that's going to go on.
Okay, let's move on to two stories, which, as I said at the top, might seem niche, but are probably actually quite important to the future of British politics. And that's access talks and the role of the cabinet secretary. And for this, we're dialing in IFG's deputy director and access talks expert, Emma Norris. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Hannah.
So can you run us through what happened this week and what access talks actually are?
Yeah, so the story this week that was in the Times was that before he went on medical leave, the Cabinet Secretary, Simon Case, asked the Prime Minister to authorise access talks with the opposition, but the Prime Minister refused, apparently worrying it could signal that an election was imminent. Now, for listeners who aren't initiated in this, like us nerds at IFG, access talks are basically formal talks between the civil service and opposition leaders that are held in the run-up to a general election. Because in our system, the handover of power usually takes place overnight. You know, you win an election, you're in government. Access talks are basically the opportunity in advance of the election for the civil service and an incoming government to sit down together and to exchange information on policy priorities, start establishing some of those relationships with each other in advance. They've been running for absolutely years and years since about the mid-1960s. And they're pretty unique because they're completely confidential. Normally, there's no contact between civil servants and shadow ministers. But these talks, when they start, are held without ministers having a right to know anything about the content of the discussions. All that happens is the Prime Minister signs them off, and then that's all the current government know about them. I did think with this story, though, there were a couple of things that weren't totally clear. Was Case actually asking for talks to begin, or was he merely asking that Sunak confirmed he was happy for them to go ahead once Labour put in a letter? So essentially Case wanted kind of pre-authorisation before he was going on sick leave, and I suspect it's the latter. And
which isn't how it normally works, right? There's normally a sort of pre-authorisation almost from the start of the Parliament, so that at the point at which the opposition requests they start, they can start.
Exactly. And I think that's the kind of one of the key questions here. There's no indication that Labour have put in a letter asking for access talks to begin. If they had, and the Prime Minister had said no, I think it's likely we'd have heard that in the press. And so I think the real question is, when is that letter going to go in to request the start of talks, given that it's already late at the moment compared to prior elections? And when that letter does go in, will the Prime Minister agree at that point? Normally, the Prime Minister agrees when the letter goes in, but there are exceptions. In 1991, Neil Kinnock wrote to John Major asking for access talks to begin, and Major turned him down, and they didn't end up beginning until 6 months before the election. So there is precedent for a Prime Minister turning down the start of talks when they're first requested, but I'm not sure that's what's happened yet in this example.
And the average time ahead of an election, certainly a scheduled election like this one, is actually quite long, isn't it? I mean, Sunak, if his objection was, and we only have the Times word for this, that, you know, people would think an election was imminent if he granted access talks to start, that doesn't really tally with what we know about what's happened in the past, does it?
Not at all, quite the opposite. There's no indication that when access talks start, an election is imminent. If you take other transitional elections as a guide, so 97, 2010, access talks normally started about 16 months out from the end of a parliament. Gordon Brown authorised contact between the Conservative Party and the opposition 15 months in advance of the 2010 election. So, you know, if you assume that an election's going to take place towards the end of next year, then the talks are already late. If we end up with a May election, then they are extremely late. So it would be completely normal and in keeping for access talks to have started at this point of the electoral cycle.
Alex, what sorts of things do access talks normally cover? And what's it like being a civil servant when they begin?
I suppose on your second question, the first thing to say is that nothing changes for the vast majority of civil servants. You know, there are 500,000 civil servants in the country, and we're talking about, you know, a few dozen or maybe a few more than that. So not a lot changes for most of the civil service. They carry on working on whatever they've been working on anyway. For the you know, small number of civil servants who are involved, you know, it's really interesting. As exactly as Emma said, it's not that common that you get the chance to go and talk to the opposition party. There's a sort of huge premium on the information that's exchanged. You know, what is this potentially the sorts of policies and other things that we'll be working on over the course of the next parliament? So there is a sort of energy and excitement in terms of what they cover. The formal position is that the civil servants are on receive mode. So shadow spokespeople are sharing their plans, and that allows the government then to sort of determine the way that the work they'll do during the election campaign in order to prepare. In practice, it's a little bit more, you know, fluid than that. You know, you wouldn't be human to be sitting in a room saying, well, you want to do this. Actually, what are the, you know, capability restraints of a department? It would never get into kind of kicking around policy areas, and certainly a civil servant would never say, well, actually, that policy is not going to work. You should do something else. But they might say, well, given the resource constraints, given the numbers of people that we have, given our setup, these are the sorts of things that you might want to think about as you go into it. But it's kept pretty high level. I mean, the other thing, my only main involvement in access talks was in the 2017 election, when I was head of office, principal private secretary to the cabinet secretary at the time. And unlike the situations that Emma was describing of sort of 16 months or longer, that clearly was an incredibly compressed situation. So they were quite, you know, they were very rapid. It was more about just establishing contact and relationships rather than going through in any detail what the government might do. But the critical thing, and I remember Jeremy Hayward saying, you know, to all his permanent secretary and other colleagues, is whatever happens in this election, this is our moment of engagement with the Labour Party. if they lose, then this will still colour their view of the civil service for the next 5 years. And it's really important for the reputation of the civil service that we go into this seriously. We don't write off the Labour Party as a potential future government, nor do we lean into it too far. It's the moment of sort of maximum professional skills that kick in for those really senior civil servants.
Because Emma, one of the important things is just that fact of sort of rapport building, isn't it, between the opposition and senior civil servants, so that if they win the election, when they walk into the room on the first day to meet their permanent secretary, they're not a stranger.
That's exactly right. I mean, actually, one of the things that we found in our research is that's the main benefit of Access Talks, or one of the main benefits, strengthening that, building that relationship between normally a permanent secretary and a shadow secretary of state in the event that shadow secretary of state goes into government. And that's actually another reason it's really important for the opposition to think about, you know, stability in their own team. Once those talks have started and those relationships have started to be built, there is some danger in holding another reshuffle before the election, because actually you start to, you know, pull those relationships apart, put somebody new into role who has to start from scratch. So that kind of stability is quite important. And just picking up on Alex's discretion point, because they're relationship based and then there is some discretion, you see quite different things happening in different circumstances. Sometimes, you know, the Access Talks are pretty top line. You know, there might be kind of one meeting every couple of months, just describing the barest bones of policy detail. Sometimes they're really quite in depth, particularly when the relationships work. I think it was in 1997, one of the examples we were looking at was Ed Balls, actually, rather than Gordon Brown. Ed Balls was Gordon Brown's advisor at the time. And, you know, in the final stage of Access Talks then, I think Ed Balls was seeing Terry Burns, the permanent secretary at the Treasury at the time, about two or three times a week to talk through some of the detail. You know, that's probably the most extreme and involved example, but there is a really wide degree of variety.
Laura, you can tell that we at the RFG are really interested in this subject, but do you think it feels like a significant story?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I, you know, the timing of the election is the thing that everyone's talking about. I think it also speaks to the changeability of government over the past few years as well. And Rishi Sunak is probably in denial a bit. He's been prime minister for a little over a year, and normally somebody would be having these conversations when they'd already had 4 years in office. And he probably feels a bit kind of, you know, don't want to start talking about leaving yet, or, you know, or at least having another election. And I think people like the sort of wargaming of, if the election's going to be made, does it need to be then? And as you say, actually, it's, you know, the timing isn't significant in that way, because they should have already started regardless. But I think he's probably going to want to hold off starting this sort of stuff as much as he's going to want to hold off actually having the election.
I'm actually considering having a ban on speculation of the date of the election on this podcast, but do you think there's anything we should read into this for that speculation?
Not with this, no. I mean, there was a lot of talk last week around the budget of, were they preparing for an election? And I think Isaac Levida had been made permanent. And I think that was just Tories being giddy about the fact that they'd got a tax cut and they were happy. And, you know, there's still nothing to indicate that this would be a good time, or May would be a good time, for the government to go into election. And I think the significance of Rishi Sunak wanting to reach 2 years can't be underestimated as well. So I'd be surprised to see it happen in May.
But yeah, I think far more important, there was a little micro story about the Conservatives being a bit cagey about how their party conference was going to play out. I think that's far more significant for the sort of the election speculation than Access Talks or anything else like it. I mean, on the timing of Access Talks, just to sort of come back to that for a second, it's striking that the examples Emma gave were five-year parliaments that went to their full length that could have only been four-year parliaments, so the Prime Minister could have chosen. That's why you get to the sort of 16, 18-month figure. And that's when there's uncertainty over whether they're timing it. So it's less about a kind of, is this a transitional moment, and more about, is it that the Prime Minister might call an election after 4 years or 5 years?
And the original story that we're talking about here was linked to Simon Case, and the fact of Simon Case potentially having talked about this with the Prime Minister before he went on medical leave. So let's turn to that story now. Alex, how is the government filling the gap in Simon Case's absence?
Yes, yeah, so Simon Case has been on leave for a month or so now, I think just over. The first thing, I mean, on this subject, I'll come to the question in a minute, but it's really, I think, important to say is that you know, obviously he needs and has a right to time to get better. And it's completely legitimate for a cabinet secretary to take time off on medical leave, just as Boris Johnson did when he had COVID, and indeed as cabinet secretaries have done in the past. The point that I and we raised last week thinking about this was the sustainability of the cover arrangements, because as you suggest, there is a quite an elaborate setup at the moment to cover for the cabinet secretary in his absence. Chris Wormald, who's the longest serving permanent secretary, is doing some parts of the role, some of the brokering. Sarah Healy, who's the permanent secretary at the Levelling Up department, is doing some of the sort of human resources and people side of it. Alex Chisholm is doing the leadership of the civil service, chief operating officer, civil service. There's a director general called Emma Churchill, who's sitting next to the Prime Minister in Cabinet taking minutes. So it's a kind of fragmented system, which maybe for a week or two is fine, but that is starting to feel unsustainable when you have such huge things happening. One of the values of the Cabinet Secretary, and I think there's a bit of a question as to whether the Prime Minister really kind of gets this at the moment, is the ability to knit together all of these threads and having a single figure who can. You know, the example that came to my mind was during that quite difficult Remembrance weekend when there were marches and disruptions, and the Home Secretary and the Metropolitan Police Commissioner didn't appear to be talking, a Cabinet Secretary can kind of step in and be, you know, be a big figure representing the government, not just the Prime Minister or the Home Secretary or something. So I do think, you know, completely fair for and right for Simon Case to take time off, but a proper interim figure would be who can step into that job would be you know, better than this fragmented arrangement we've got at the moment. Question then arises as to who that is, and please, Hannah, don't ask me that.
I mean, I was going to say certainly I and I think you, Alex, have had sort of indication, shall we say, from the civil service of difficulties in terms of people knowing where to go on different things and things getting, you know, a bit of a logjam at the top on various decisions that need to be made. Laura, do you feel as if this is a sustainable situation? Is it something that has come across your radar?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just speaks to the uncertainty of the situation, and I suspect that Simon Case wants to get back to work, and, you know, don't want to speculate about his medical condition, but you know, as soon as he's able to do that, he probably will. But I suppose for the new year, if he can't come back in the new year, then yeah, a single figure is going to have to step in, I think. I mean, it's a crucial year and it's a crucial job, and I imagine it's just very bad timing for everyone involved, isn't it?
And just to link back to what we were talking about before, Emma, is it a problem if the Cabinet Secretary is not around for access talks?
Well, I think, you know, as has just been said, it is a crucial year. There's more likely than not to be an election next year. If not, it will be just after next year in January 25. So it does feel like a bit of a disadvantage for the civil service to be potentially starting that year without a cabinet secretary in post. Of course, you know, exactly as Alex has described with other aspects of the cabinet secretary role, there are other people in Whitehall who can take on some of that coordination of the access talks. There are quite a few permanent secretaries who have, you know, very high level experience, a very senior experience of access talks. But I do think that there are some kind of potentially quite particular challenges this time round, because I wonder whether Labour are going to want to do something a bit different to usual or have some additional things as part of access talks. You know, Labour's main policy platform, at least for now at the moment, is their five missions. And those missions don't sit neatly across. They don't sit neatly within one department, perhaps with the exception of the NHS one. They sit across a whole range of departments. They're, you know, what we kind of describe as cross-cutting. And so I wonder, given that, whether Labour are going to want to do some kind of cross-cutting access talks as well, not just a talk at a kind of Shadow Secretary of State to PermSec level, but to bring a group of people together. Now, that's been attempted before in access talks, but it's never come off. And I think it is quite difficult to start trying something which has proved challenging before, something new, if you don't have that leadership right at the top of the civil service in place.
Emma, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks all.
Alice, the IFG does a lot of work on the role of ministers. Presumably with access talks, it's important that future ministers understand a bit about how the civil service works and the sort of position it's in ahead of an election.
Yeah, it's really important. And this actually comes back to something Emma mentioned as well, which is the fact that in our system, changes of government happen effectively overnight. They happen very quickly. We don't have that long kind of transition period that we see in places like the US. And so for new ministers, it can be incredibly confusing. They get a phone call from the Prime Minister to say, I would like you to do this particular job. And suddenly you have all of these new responsibilities. You have all of this stuff that you have to get up to speed on that perhaps you've never really encountered before. And it's worth saying, because I think sometimes it takes people a bit by surprise, there is no formal training for ministers. We sort of throw them into these jobs and effectively expect them to sink or swim. That's why our IFG Academy exists and tries to work with ministers and potential future ministers to give them some of that training and support and time to actually think about what their new job might entail, because the way that we do it otherwise isn't really the way that we would do sort of jobs or recruitment in any other sector. Being a minister is such a specific job. So yes, what that also means is that anything that helps with kind of long-term planning helps get people who one day might be government ministers to actually understand what the job entails, what some of their responsibilities or some of their duties might be, is incredibly helpful. And obviously Access Talks are a kind of prime source of that.
And Alex, at some point we will end up needing a new cabinet secretary, whether that happens in the near future or much further ahead. You argued in your piece for us last week that we should modernise the way we pick our cabinet secretaries.
Yeah, a modest constitutional innovation. And I think particularly after a time of, you know, turbulence and some disruption in the civil service, as we've talked about a lot on this podcast and elsewhere, it would be a good thing for a prime minister who's selecting a cabinet secretary, whether that's Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer or anybody else, to build into that process of selection some consultation or involvement of the opposition party. Now, I can see that this is, you know, controversial. It's it's a government appointment, and bringing in an opposition party, particularly one whose chief of staff is a very senior former civil servant in Sugre, is not, you know, not uncomplicated. But I do think a prime minister to give confidence to the whole system that they are selecting the absolute best person for the job, the person who has the capability and has the confidence of the opposition, would be of benefit. I can see why actually oppositions might be a little bit queasy about that, because you're sort of dipping their hands in it, and it limits their room for manoeuvre, and they're being potentially bound into a decision over which they don't have total control. So it's not uncomplicated, but I think the benefits outweigh the risks. And I do think we really need to avoid getting into a situation where a cabinet secretary, you know, there was some contention around the appointment of Simon Case and the involvement of Dominic Cummings and so on, where a cabinet secretary becomes sort of automatically or semi-automatically replaced when a prime minister changes. If they want the right person for the job, that should be an area of common interest for the prime minister and anyone who wants to be a future prime minister, rather than, you know, we want our person in that job who is going to transact our agenda. So I would, however this plays out over the course of the next year or two, I would really, really think we should need to avoid a situation where the person who's doing that job just before the election is replaced just after the election.
Well, let's end with a story that's causing a problem for the government right now, and that's immigration, and specifically the government's plan to fly some asylum seekers to Rwanda. Laura, it feels like it's been a tricky week for the new Home Secretary.
Yeah, and I mean, the words that we're hearing from Tory MPs are despair, despondency, unspoken tension was the headline of the story that we had on Politics Home on this today. People are, well, Tory MPs particularly, are impatient to see this emergency legislation and the details of it that Rishi Sunak has promised, but it's not here. I think it's a very difficult situation for them, because I think there is a pragmatic part of the government that knows that pulling out of the European Convention of Human Rights and the UN Refugee Convention is just not a good idea and is going to cause different international tensions and troubles. But then they also need to settle this kind of war on the right of the party, and which feels like an impossible situation. Plus, even when they do put this emergency legislation through, does that get flights taking off? There was a story today in the Times, I think, about Rwanda starting to get quite impatient, and the worry that when this debate comes up in Parliament, there's going to be a lot of people who are hugely critical of Rwanda, and there now seems to be some kind of risk that Rwanda says, "I don't want anything to do with this anyway." Whether or not the government is starting to explore other countries, that's certainly been suggested, although I don't think there's been any solid detail on where or any actual talks. But yeah, it feels like another impossible problem to solve for Rishi Sunak.
And does your story refer also to that tension between, it seems, the Home Secretary and the Immigration Minister on this?
Well, there seems to be a lot of talk this week that Robert Jemrick could be on his own sort of leadership tip, as he's sort of taken over from Suella Braverman there. I mean, I think it was very considered that he was the person sort of running the show on this anyway. So maybe he does step up. And yeah, whether or not James Cleverly feels a bit trodden on toes there, I'm not sure.
We shall see. Alice, you've done some great digging into the technicalities of the government's plan to resurrect its flights. What is it planning, in short?
So in short, what the Prime Minister has said is that there will be a new treaty with Rwanda that will supersede the memorandum of understanding that currently exists between the UK and Rwanda. So that's one aspect of what the government wants to do. The second aspect is, as Laura has already mentioned, the government has said that they want to bring forward emergency legislation. Beyond that, though, we don't really know any details. We don't know what the content of that emergency legislation will be. We don't really know what the content of any treaty with Rwanda will be. Obviously, it seems that the point of both of these things is to try and get around or assuage the concerns that the Supreme Court raised in making its ruling on the Rwanda scheme. But we still don't actually know, a couple of weeks on from that decision, exactly what the government will try and do with either of those things. We simply know that it plans to do them.
So there's been some discussion that if the government does legislate on this, the House of Lords might not be too happy. And because it wasn't originally a manifesto commitment, the Lords might be able to block it in some way. But you've argued the Parliament Act wouldn't be an option for the government to ram it through in these circumstances.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So certainly any emergency legislation on this, I think, would certainly run into difficulties in the House of Lords. We've seen sort of the House of Lords' attitudes on similar kinds of bills, so like the illegal migration bill previously, but also because of what this legislation might actually be trying to do in constitutional terms, which is effectively use the legislative power of Parliament to try and circumvent a ruling by the Supreme Court. Those kinds of constitutional issues are ones that the House of Lords tend to be very concerned with. But as you say, in this particular instance, the government does not have the option of the Parliament Act. And the reason for that is simply one of timing. So there are some very detailed timing requirements that have to be met on a piece of legislation for the government to use the Parliament Act to ram it through. But at the moment, because of where we are in the Parliament and because of the final end date of this Parliament, which is set out itself in law, the government cannot meet those timing requirements to use the Parliament Act. So they know that they do not have that option. And as you say, this is not something that was a manifesto commitment. So the Lords will not feel bound by the convention that they shouldn't delay or block it. So it is likely that this will run into potentially quite a lot of difficulty in the House of Lords, where it's also worth remembering the government doesn't control timing in the same way. They can't close down or limit debate in the same way that they can in the Commons. So they're potentially facing quite a tricky time in the upper house.
Alex, is this a potential crisis for the Conservative Party, or is it, given that, you know, even if the Supreme Court had given the go-ahead for this policy, the chances of it actually sort of getting implemented and having the effect the government wants to see before an election would have been slim in any case, is it actually quite good for the government to be fighting the Lords, fighting the courts right up to the date of the next election?
Well, it certainly is a potential crisis for the Conservative Party, as we can see from the fragmentation of views and the fact they're stirring things up in ways that divide rather than unite the party. I mean, I suspect, as well as the importance of solving the issue of small boats crossing the Channel and illegal migration, part of the political rationale behind this was to raise the salience of it and to create a dividing line. And as you say, you can do that while opposing the courts and the House of Lords and so on. But part of the problem with that is they've raised the salience of the issue, but the public, from the polling I've seen anyway, doesn't seem to have much confidence that the government has a plan that will actually resolve it. So they've sort of emphasized their own impotence. And I think there is a point where going into battle with the courts and Parliament tips over into, well, why can't you get the thing done then? The other thing, and this is just, I raise this because it's a bit frustrating, is in this debate, there's been quite a lot of briefing recently about, full fat options or semi-skimmed options, or, which seems to mean, do you leave the European Convention on Human Rights entirely in order to get over this problem? Do you derogate it from it in certain kind of specific, limited and specific, to coin a phrase, ways? Or do you try and operate within the framework? And it does feel like, you can see why people are doing this, but the whole debate is getting in a very overcomplicated. And I think people are trying to find political ways out when actually the European Convention on Human Rights question is quite simple. Are you arguing to leave that? That's a legitimate position. I mean, it's one that puts you in, you know, some quite dodgy company internationally, but it's a completely legitimate position to say we should leave the European Convention on Human Rights. Or are you saying we need to find a solution, not just to the fetishized Rwanda policy, but to the problem of illegal immigration within the framework of the European Convention on Human Rights? And I feel I'm wheeling out lots of war stories today, so sorry. But I was one of the civil servants leading the team doing prisoner voting rights about 10 years ago, which was a huge ECHR crisis, not quite as big as this. But there was, you know, there was talk of derogating or leaving from the ECHR on that. But it was the response to that in the end, actually from the Labour government, as well as the Conservative government, was ducking and weaving and trying to just sort of manage this and decrease its salience rather than increase it. I'll stop going off on one about about my history in the civil service.
Laura, do you think migration, particularly illegal migration, is going to be a big issue at the next election?
Yes, because obviously voters care about it. I think there is a definite attempt to conflate legal and illegal migration at the moment. I mean, we've seen a definite hardening on the stance on legal migration in the last couple of weeks. And I think part of that is possibly because it shows action on migration in a way that is probably a bit more achievable for the government. And I think the sort of internal party politics of, you know, both sides of it, of trying to just kind of satisfy the hardliners on migration where they can't do that on illegal migration because it's, you know, all the problems we just discussed, it means that they can satisfy the hardliners on legal migration. But I think it will. And it's a difficult one for Labour as well. So it's a nice way for the Tories to set traps for them because, I mean, obviously with the legal migration issue this week and how that affects things like the health sector and workers, actually Labour kind of needs to say, yes, we will have more migrants for these particular jobs. But then that's an easy thing for the government to hit back and say, well, I mean, I think they have already done that, haven't they? There's a line that goes around that Keir Starmer wants 100,000 more migrants or something. But so I think it's a good way of trapping Labour. And I mean, Labour's doing quite a good job this week, I think, of just not staying out of it, but not committing to anything in particular. I mean, the only thing I've really heard them commit to is getting the number down to 200,000, which conveniently for them is the ONS's prediction of where it'll be anyway.
Like halving inflation.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the interesting thing is, isn't it, that with Brexit, we have very much repatriated this question of migration. It's no longer possible for politicians to do what they used to do and bemoan the fact that free movement meant we couldn't control our borders and that we couldn't control how many EU citizens were coming to the UK. This now does come down to real political choices about, you know, are you bringing in the people who will run our care homes, or are you keeping numbers down? And that's difficult for the government and difficult for the opposition parties.
Yeah, but also to get back to what you said earlier about will Brexit be a defining issue in the next election? Yes and no, in that the public see it as a done deal. People don't want to have another Brexit election, but a lot of the ideology behind the Brexit vote was immigration. So do they just translate it and it's in new words and actually, yeah, this is now the Brexit issue?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose to your point, Hannah, about the repatriation, I mean, we saw the same on trade deals as well. We hadn't had to kind of have both a capability or a take responsibility in the UK for trade deals because they were done at the European Union level. So to that extent, it's really healthy that there's a debate with meaningful outcomes. I suppose the unhealthy aspect of that is if it was the European Union that was the scapegoat for some of these things previously, politicians who feel impotent can then start to look for other scapegoats. And I don't want to get too dark on that, but it, you know, there's a danger that if we don't handle this policy question, you know, in a sort of democratically and politically healthy way, it starts to go in unhealthy directions.
That is a rather negative note on which to end. Thanks, Alex. That's it for today. Thank you to Alice Lilly, Alex Thomas, Emma Norris, and especially to Laura Silver. Great that you could be with us. And thank you to everyone who's listened in. You can find all our Inside Briefing episodes and all our podcasts at iTunes, Spotify, and all major platforms. Do subscribe and please leave us a review. I reckon something like Inside Briefing has the Midas touch, has a nice ring to it. Remember to head to our website for all our commentary and explainers on access talks, the role of the Cabinet Secretary, the government's Rwanda plans, and more. Until then, have a happy weekend, everyone, and try to avoid accidentally starting any major diplomatic incidents. Thank you.